Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mark Klein, a former AT&T technician and whistleblower, who explains what was revealed in new documents released by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden, describing the unique relationship between the NSA and AT&T. Journalist, author, and community organizer Jordan Flaherty, who discusses the major economic changes influenced by race and class that have transformed the city of New Orleans 10 years after Hurricane Katrina. And NAACP National Field Director Carmen Watkins, who talks about America's Journey for Justice March from Selma, Alabama to Washington, D.C., that's mobilizing activists in five southern states. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Pentagon is planning a 50% expansion in daily U.S. drone flights in the Middle East, as well as in emerging conflict zones, including Ukraine and the South China Sea. In Southeast Asia, the U.S. Navy and China are engaged in a dispute over territorial rights and control over sea lanes. The Diplomat magazine reports the Pentagon's surveillance activities near the disputed Spratly Islands were disrupted by Chinese jamming operations. In the near future, the U.S. Air Force is planning to upgrade its drone fleet in Asia to more advanced MQ-9 Reaper drones. To back up its land claims in the South China Sea, China is building islands over 800 miles off its coastline. The contested Spratly Islands have major oil and natural gas reserves, as well as healthy fisheries. The islands also are in a strategic location near international sea lanes. Asia observers say the U.S. Navy's doctrine of freedom of navigation operations could easily backfire. By pressing its international sea rights, the U.S. military could give China an excuse to ignore any future regional agreements and expand its military footprint in the South China Sea. On the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II, Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe expressed utmost grief for the damage and suffering inflicted by Japan during the war, but did not apologize for Japanese atrocities. Abe's anniversary speech fell far short of the full apology made 20 years ago by then Prime Minister Tomichi Murayama for Japan's legacy of aggression and colonial rule. China and South Korea, whose people were victimized by the invading Japanese, were cool to Abe's speech, which commemorated the day in 1945 when Emperor Hirohito surrendered just days after the U.S. dropped atomic bombs over Hiroshima and Nagasaki. China is still bitter about the 1937 rape of Nanking, where Japanese soldiers killed over 200,000 people and raped tens of thousands of women. In Korea, which Japan occupied for 35 years, women and girls were forced to work in brothels for Japanese soldiers. The Japanese government first apologized for the use of comfort women in 1993. With Abe's ties to right-wing revisionist forces, there is fear Japan may bury its past of wartime atrocities and roll back the nation's pacifist constitution. Abe first raised alarm in China after his public visit to the Yakasuni Shrine, which honors Japan's war dead, including hundreds of war criminals. Chinese historian Zhang Zanwen observed, "It is not that China or Korea won't let go of these issues. It's that Japan has not sincerely recognized the historical issues and keeps changing its stance." 3 years ago, Walmart workers boldly launched a strike in 100 cities to protest their working conditions at the hands of the world's largest retailer. After years of silence and failed union campaigns, low-income workers found their voice to complain about low wages and few benefits. Years of public pressure on Walmart finally led the big retailer to raise its lowest wage to $9 an hour this spring. The union-backed campaign, Our Walmart, standing for Organization United for Respect at Walmart, is being downsized by its sponsor, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, or UFCW. According to the news magazine In These Times, critics inside the UFCW say the campaign was too expensive and didn't enlist any new union members. The streamlined Our Walmart campaign will focus on media and public relations strategies to expose dirt about Walmart rather than cultivating grassroots action. At the same time, the UFCW plans to roll out a broader retail sector organizing campaign. But recently, a network of progressive donors has stepped forward to underwrite the Our Walmart organizing drive. Steve Lerner, who led the Justice for Janitors campaign, praised the member-focused drive for winning concrete concessions from Walmart and devising innovative social media strategies instead of frustrated workers being left to scream into a void. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden, who remains in self-imposed exile in Russia, released new documents recently which reveal the scope of telecom giant AT&T's decades-long relationship with the NSA. The documents, covering the period from 2003 to 2013, disclose that AT&T's partnership with the NSA included providing the spy agency access to billions of domestic emails and offered technical assistance in carrying out a secret court order permitting the wiretapping of all internet communications at the United Nations headquarters in New York City. The documents examined by the New York Times and ProPublica also reveal that in 2011, AT&T gave the NSA access to 1.1 billion domestic cell phone records a day. The company, which in that same year earned $189 million from its partnership with the NSA, is reported to have installed surveillance equipment in at least 17 of its internet hubs in the United States. One of those secret hubs, in room 641A, located in the SBC Communications Building in San Francisco, was discovered in 2003 by AT&T technician Mark Klein. 3 years later, Klein launched a lawsuit against AT&T with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which claimed that the company was providing the NSA access to internet traffic from other telecom companies. When Congress provided telecommunications companies working with the NSA retroactive immunity in 2008, the suit was dismissed. Your reporter spoke with Mark Klein, who discusses his decision to publicly disclose what he knew about AT&T's surveillance, what the new Snowden documents reveal, and his view of recent congressional reforms of the NSA surveillance program.
Well, I was working at AT&T for about 20 years already when I was working in a little AT&T office in San Francisco. And we heard that the NSA was installing a secret room nearby at the major central office at 611 Folsom Street. We heard this because the NSA actually sent the agent in to talk to the guy who would be working in there and give him clearance. So word spreads around pretty quickly among a small number of people. So the following year, I was transferred to that office. So I already knew when I arrived there that there was this NSA installation. And I was put in charge of the internet room by coincidence. And part of my job was to connect fiber optic circuits to what was called a splitter cabinet. And I got hold of engineering documents which clearly showed what was going on. The splitters, which are just glass prisms that split the light beam, which carries the information. By splitting the light beam, the splitters were copying the data stream going through that office. And the copy was going down to the secret room. The documents I had clearly showed that. And so I was actually kind of angry because I was basically, as I thought, wiring up the Big Brother machine, which I used for my book later. But at the time, I didn't feel like I could do much about it. It was too scary, and I didn't want to lose my job. So I just took some notes and observations. I came forward later in 2006.
And more recently, former NSA contractor Edward Snowden revealed new documents that reveal the extent of AT&T's decade-long relationship with the NSA and surveillance of Americans. You followed the story closely. What should Americans know about AT&T's cooperation with the NSA from at least 2003 to 2013?
Well, thank goodness for Edward Snowden, I should say, first off, and he should get immunity instead of the phone companies. His documents prove that this was going on. I had to argue that this was going on because they tried to dismiss me as a nobody who had documents that were just AT&T documents. But Snowden had NSA documents that they can't deny. And he showed the extensive cooperation, not just with AT&T, but with Verizon and the taps going in on the transatlantic cables to Europe. It's a worldwide operation. And how they're tapping into people's email on Google and Yahoo and all the rest. So it was a huge expose which vindicated me. And the latest New York Times article mentioned also, by the way, that the cooperation between the AT&T and the NSA goes back to 1985, which I don't think anybody knew about that. That's way before 9/11. Which is usually the excuse they use for this collaboration. I don't know what they were doing in 1985. There was only a little internet back then. Mainly it was CompuServe. So maybe they were spying on CompuServe. I don't know. But anyway, it was an indication of how far back this cooperation goes.
Mark Klein, the USA Freedom Act was signed into law in June of this year. While there are many advocates for this bill, which was a reform bill for FISA surveillance, there are many civil libertarians who are dissatisfied with the scope of what was covered in this reform. What's your view of the USA Freedom Act and the reforms they put in place?
I think that's a fake reform bill to make people feel better. It was the most minimalist attempt to touch things up and cosmetically make it look nicer. First of all, the bill did not address the secret rooms and the internet side of what they were doing. What it was only addressing was what they call the phone metadata program, where, you know, it came out that Verizon was collecting every quarter the phone metadata from everybody in the country that used Verizon. The metadata is like who's calling who on your phone number, right? But that tells a lot about you if the government gets hold of that kind of information. So people were upset about that. So what the bill did was instead of the NSA collecting it directly, the phone companies collect it, and then the NSA is supposed to approach them now and just ask for it through some kind of FISA warrant probably. And so in that way, the phone companies act as a middleman, and that's supposed to make you feel better. But as I say, the AT&T is all too willing to give them whatever the heck they want, so I don't think that that makes any difference. It only addresses the phone metadata program. It does not address the billions and billions of communications they scoop up off the Internet. The secret rooms remain in place, and that bill did not address that at all. The best intelligence is human intelligence. When someone is on the inside and passes along information that this person is doing something suspicious. And that requires footwork and old-fashioned detective work, which they want to believe that some computer can do the work for them, but it doesn't work that way.
That was Mark Klein, a retired AT&T technician, who in 2006 blew the whistle on AT&T's cooperation with the NSA. Klein is author of the book, Wiring Up the Big Brother Machine and Fighting It. For more perspectives on NSA surveillance, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. August 29th marks the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina and all the devastation and displacement it caused. The city of New Orleans, in the direct path of the storm, has been rebuilt in ways that have excluded many of its poor and black residents. One Louisiana congressman observed that Katrina enabled the power structure to do what it hadn't been able to do previously, tear down virtually all the public housing and rebuild mixed-income developments that are better for those who got to live in them, but which prevented thousands of poor African Americans from returning to their city. Approximately 100,000 black residents are still displaced 10 years after Katrina, and housing prices continue to rise. According to a survey conducted by Louisiana State University's Center for Media and Public Affairs, nearly 80% of New Orleans white residents say that Louisiana has mostly recovered since the storm, while nearly 60% of black people say that the state has mostly not recovered. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus made several trips to New Orleans following Katrina, where she reported for this program and other media outlets, as well as volunteering in various capacities. Melinda recently spoke with Jordan Flaherty, a journalist, community organizer, and author of the book, Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to Jenna 6, about the changes that have come to the city since Katrina, and the grassroots struggles to promote the interests of people who've been marginalized by those changes. Here he begins by talking about the takeover of New Orleans public schools by the charter school movement after Katrina.
Before the storm, we did have a very problematic school system where we had some very good schools and we had some very bad schools. And when the storm came, I think certain powerful forces saw this as an opportunity to reshape the school system. Breaking down roughly on lines of race, I would say the white power structure of the city felt that the problem with the school system was the school board and the teachers and the teachers' union. So they went about destroying the school board, the power of the school board, the teachers' union, and the teachers. Overall, and again, obviously there's differences, but many black people in the city felt that the problem was a lack of funding, infrastructure that was falling apart, low teacher salaries. And those problems were not really addressed. Now, there has been a lot of money that came in because there's a lot of these foundations, including Oprah Winfrey and the Gates Foundation, that are very excited about charter schools. It's sort of a cause that unites liberals and conservatives and neoconservatives. A couple of years ago, Newt Gingrich and Al Sharpton doing a tour together where they were both talking about charter schools as the one item they could agree on. So you had this sort of unified front of money that went in to these charter schools, and it did make some better, but also brings up the question, couldn't you have also improved local schools had you put that money into them? So now there is more money being spent too, but I think for a kid with small resources, they're not necessarily better now than they were before Katrina.
I was talking to a homeowner from New Orleans last week who said she'd never be able to afford a house in the post-Katrina market. So what caused the big jump in housing prices?
Home prices overall citywide have gone up 46% since Hurricane Katrina. That's to buy homes. And in certain neighborhoods, the prices are going up by about 10% per year. Rent prices have gone up even more, especially in some neighborhoods. And it's still very inexpensive when you compare it to home prices in New York or in California, but we just don't have the economy of those cities. Most people are still reliant on these service economy jobs, jobs in the tourism industry, many of them being minimum wage jobs. And with a minimum wage job, it is very hard to afford rent, or certainly almost impossible to afford to buy a home in the city today. So increasingly, black residents of the city are pushed further out or indeed into the suburbs. The percentage of black people in the suburbs has actually gone up slightly because they cannot afford to live in the city anymore.
So big picture, Jordan Flaherty, what do you see as the forces reshaping New Orleans into a whiter, wealthier city than it was before Katrina?
When you look at it, it's overall about the direction of the recovery. You know, there's $71 billion of federal funding that was spent. And a lot of that disproportionately went to the wealthier neighborhoods. I think the clearest example of that is the federally funded, state-administered program called the Road Home Program. This was probably the biggest source of money to people that wanted to rebuild. Now, first of all, this program only went to homeowners. So it completely left out renters in the funding, the support for being able to come back. Then even within homeowners, the money that people would get was based on property values. So you could have two homes that had the same amount of damage, same square footage, same cost to rebuild. If one of those homes was in a white neighborhood, they would get more money than the home in a black neighborhood. And overall, within that program, white homeowners got about 40% more money than black homeowners, which added up to tens of thousands of dollars per person in difference. That's a huge part of why it became harder for people to live here. You also have the demolition of public housing, right? That's thousands of units of affordable housing that were taken off the market. And when you take thousands of low-income units off the market, that raises the housing market for everybody.
Do you have any final words on the current situation?
I would just say that there is this incredibly vibrant resistance here. There's incredible organizing that's happening. The Congress of Day Labor is an organization in the Latino community here that has up to 400 members coming to their weekly meetings. You have Breakout, which is an organization of LGBT youth of color who are dealing with the prison industrial complex that have won real changes in policies around policing and in the jail. You have Women with a Vision, that's an organization that's worked with indigenous women, especially drug users and sex workers, and have organized for rights for that community. So you have a really vibrant social justice tapestry here that is fighting for changes. And I think what people from other cities can really learn from this experience, is the way that people have fought against these neoliberal changes.
That was Jordan Flaherty, a journalist, author, and activist based in New Orleans. Find more news and commentary on the post-Katrina economic challenges facing New Orleans by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. America's Journey for Justice March began in Selma, Alabama on August 1st. The 50th anniversary of the date, President Johnson signed the historic 1965 Voting Rights Act into law. The march, which is being organized by the NAACP, will conclude with a rally in Washington, D.C. on September 16th. With support from labor unions, environmental groups, and clergy of many faiths, the 860-mile march is mobilizing activists in five southern states on the issues of reforming the U.S. criminal justice system, restoration of voting rights, establishing a living wage, and equality in education. Marchers from diverse communities are being greeted by well-wishers in cities and towns in Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia, where teach-ins focused on issues important to area residents are being held in schools and churches. While the marchers are raising consciousness about social justice struggles in each state they visit, they're also focused on the national campaign to restore the Voting Rights Act that the U.S. Supreme Court gutted in a June 2013 ruling. That high court decision effectively allowed dozens of states to implement restrictive and discriminatory voting regulations. Your reporter spoke with NAACP National Field Director Carmen Watkins, who discusses the origins and objectives of America's Journey for Justice March.
Last year, after the death of Mike Brown, we set a journey of 134 miles from Ferguson, Missouri to Jefferson City to really call for legislative change after that death. Then, you know, there's been just a lot of kind of heightened press around African Americans, the police brutality. And then there were these core issues that we have long been fighting on behalf of, a voting rights, education. So it just made sense that we would call to action the community, the broad community, to rally around the things that we've all been rallying around for a very long time. So this was our jobs, our lives, our voting rights, our schools matter. And it just makes sense. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about what you would have done if I had been around in the 60s. If I were able to, I would have. And then you can complete the blank. But often, you know, when we get opportunities to make history, when we get opportunities to engage in history, we do nothing. We stand idly by and say, oh, well, that's what they're doing. So this is an opportunity to raise awareness to those issues and to mobilize communities along the way. Each evening we spend time in a teach-in so that that community that we're going through can be impacted and changed long-term.
Carmen, I know that this march has taken inspiration from the Moral Mondays movement that got started in North Carolina and spread around the South with Reverend William Barber of the NAACP there in North Carolina leading the charge. What kind of tactics do you think the NAACP and the coalition groups that you're working with can adopt from the Moral Monday movement when it comes to pushing through a restoration of the Voting Rights Act in Congress in Washington?
Yeah. You know, I think that Reverend Barber has done a fantastic job of mobilizing partners, that no one movement can be led by just one group. And so it's going to take several voices from a diversity of audiences, and sometimes those that people may seem that would not go together, that sometimes may not always be on the same side of an issue, to join together on specific issues to push forward. And it's also going to be, I think what we know and we've known for years, is that you have to confront issues straight head on and not back down. So challenges, whether it's the heat, whether it's the length of this journey, whether it's confrontation with individuals who may not see our view, we have to stand firm and strong and continue this march step by step and meet those challenges as they come along.
As we said before, this march was launched on the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act being signed into law by Lyndon Johnson. And when you get to Washington, D.C., one major issue is on the table, and that is Republican control of the House and Senate and their inaction on a bill that would restore the 1965 Voting Rights Act that was gutted by the U.S. Supreme Court back in June 2013. That certainly has got to be a major issue for a major focus for this march. What action are you specifically going to take when it comes to restoring voting rights?
You know, I think, quite frankly, we hit this one head on. I mean, we had Republican support on this issue before. I think that we have to put really as many boots on the ground and stare these people right in the face and talk about the issue. As long as we allow people to move comfortably in inaction, they will continue to choose not to act. And so we have to really mobilize the masses of people and bring this issue to the forefront and call for action. And that's really, when it comes to voting rights, that's really what this is about.
That was NAACP National Field Director Carmen Watkins. Find more information and get updates on America's Journey for Justice March by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.